Welcome to a Migration Policy Institute podcast series on critical immigration, health, and educational policies affecting young children of immigrants. Introducing each session is Michael Fix, Senior Vice President and Director of Studies and Co-Director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. And now here's Michael.
Margie and I, as I said earlier, are going to try to kind of bravely pull together what we think are some of the salient points from principally from the papers, which we had the benefit of getting early. Thanks again to the authors for being so compliant. And as we've said, we're doing this to the purpose of, in a week or so, or down the road, trying to pull together, if you will, a letter to the president that tries to synthesize the major policy points, the major facts that are made, facts that are established over the course of the six papers, and to think through what some of the close-in policy implications of those facts on the ground might be. They're complicated, as you've seen. They are cross-cutting in some ways. And the way we're going to structure this little presentation is what I'm going to do is just summarize some of the facts from each of the different sessions. Let me tell you, this summary will be entirely arbitrary. It will be wholly idiosyncratic. The notion here is what we're just trying to do is to punctuate the day, give you kind of a mnemonic device to think back to some of the things we've heard over the course of the day, and finally to leave you kind of irritated by what I've left out. So with that, let me turn to some of the facts in the health panels that we heard earlier this morning. And I guess some of the points that struck me, this is no way to try to encompass all the facts, was first that the largest child populations, which is to say the Latino and the Mexican populations, are in many ways the most vulnerable, the most likely to be obese, the most likely to be food insecure. We heard in the course of that session that a large share of Mexican-born children of immigrants, the level of 46% struck me, it caught me unawares, are food insecure. This is a whole separate health issue that I hadn't really thought we would be grappling with over the course of this project. What we heard was that the health advantages that we see in infancy, that we write a lot about, the epidemiological paradox, seem to erode over time. What we heard is that close to half of non-citizen children are uninsured, a much higher rate than the share of citizen children who are uninsured or who don't have insurance through parents who have employment-based insurance. What we heard is that it's not just an issue for unauthorized non-citizens. Many legal non-citizen adults lack health insurance, in part because of the jobs they work, in part because of eligibility restrictions that are still left over from welfare reform. We heard that low-income, counter to what many stereotypes hold, that low-income immigrants are less likely to visit a doctor's office even when they're insured, and we heard that low-income immigrant children and adults are less likely than natives to visit emergency rooms, again, counter to the conventional received wisdom. And then finally, the final point, as I say, and it's an idiosyncratically arrayed set of points, the final point is that we saw from the Massachusetts experience that there is going to be, and we can anticipate this with the Affordable Care Act, that there will be heavy reliance on community health centers to get care. They will become critical providers, not just to unauthorized immigrants, but to legal immigrants, and especially to English language learners in the community. So there's some of the facts that we are thinking to emphasize in a letter to the president. Now, Margie will say a word or two about some of the.
So my job is to annoy you further and do the policy, the idiosyncratic policy takeaways. Actually, our emails are up at the end of this. So what we thought was just since there's not really going to probably be the time or the energy the snow hasn't started, and I think it's down to being like a half inch that's not going to stick. But we figured everybody would be ready to get going. So we just thought we're happy to have email conversations with folks if you feel like, you know, we're really missing a key other policy, you know, policy or budget pieces. So we're just going to do this back and forth, the health session, the education session, and the unauthorized and immigration law session. So the one thing I would add to these, so you can read them. I mean, these were some of the things that were pointed out in the two papers. Having more states pick up on the expansion in IHEA, that's more of a state piece, I guess, than something for the federal level. The community health center piece is definitely something that we could probably keep a better eye on and support from the federal level. The reimbursement for language services under Medicare and Medicaid continues to be a bit problematic and I believe somewhat also an interaction of federal-state issues. Definitely the expansion of access to the exchanges to legalizing populations is a key point we can push, but then that drives up the price of a bill, and that's really anathema to the folks who are trying to do the negotiating around bills, that they're very afraid that if there is access to the exchanges, that it could be, could price a bill too high and make it very difficult to make an already difficult bill even more difficult to pass. So I think for those of you who really care about the healthcare pieces, that's definitely a big one to keep your eye on. And then sustaining SNAP spending because of the important role it plays in supporting immigrant families. I just want to add, Leighton talked a little bit about language access, and I think that, you know, for those of you who work at the state or local level, you might be aware that some of the folks who are really carrying the water on immigrant issues more generally in terms of access and quality conversations often start in the linguistic and cultural access part of agencies, and we've been running a sort of technical support group for people in government who are trying to set up translation and interpretation services. And I would just say that you know, that when Leighton was saying that particularly in healthcare, the issues around use of technology to make that more affordable. I mean, we were shocked. We did forgive me, I guess I shouldn't say this if it's being recorded, but like kind of a rinky-dink little report on use of technology. And it's been downloaded 150,000 times. Like, it's ridiculous how desperate folks in government are for more guidance on that. And I do think that that's one of those areas that HHS has paid a fair, for anybody from HHS who still is in the room, we have not seen a lot of focus across federal agencies on their own responsibilities for language access. They kind of think that they pushed it down to the states who are the providers, and there really is a bit of a glass house problem for folks in state agencies about looking at what they're doing themselves in terms of linguistic and cultural access when they themselves are responsible for services, but then also their relationships with their regional offices. So I actually think there's a lot more we could do here, and we'd be very interested in hearing from any of you with ideas in that direction, because the Department of Justice definitely has an office within that's eager to do more capacity building and enforcement, and we definitely think that that's an area that we can push a little more on.
Education.
To education, we had a lot of factual takeaways, slightly longer list of factual takeaways when it comes to education. First of all, we have to talk about the scale of the issue. One in four children, under six, has at least one immigrant parent. Linda makes the point in her paper that half of four-year-olds in California are children of immigrants. Half come from families where language other than English is spoken at home. We learned from the papers that children of immigrants tend to have lower cognitive and academic skills both before and after the transition to primary school. A very important point comes through the papers that health and academic outcomes interact, so policymakers should not be thinking in silos in terms of these policy domains independently. It's important to think about them collectively, and that means it's important to think beyond the four brick walls of the school. We see that there's a growing evidence that the benefits of high-quality instruction benefit dual language learners. And then what we find from our own work, and it's borne out in the work that in the papers here, is that there's widely this notion that our understandings are becoming more nuanced. There's widely varying access to early childhood education across different groups from different sending areas, different regions, so that we find in some of our own work in the book that we've given you, that children of black immigrants have comparatively high uses of early childhood center-based education. Asians do as well. Latinos tend to lag. Linda makes the point that young dual language learners are served in predominantly monolingual programs, and by predominantly monolingual teachers, there's very few dual language learners who actually receive exposure to bilingual classrooms. And she makes the point very strongly that there's a growing consensus in the literature that bilingual education in preschool is additive, not subtractive, which again runs against many of the stereotypes that are out there in the public marketplace. She makes the point that while all teachers can't be expected to be bilingual, all teachers can be expected to support all languages, something that they can start to do on Monday, as she put it. And she made the point that 25%, and we also have the point that 25% of children of immigrants have parents with less than a high school degree. 48% of Hispanic immigrant mothers have less than a high school degree. And then the final point here is the importance of parent knowledge and skills and family and bilateral family-school partnerships as opposed to unilateral expectations imposed on parents themselves.
So there's obviously a big policy agenda here. The issue of teacher quality is just huge. So this first bullet about incorporating training for working with young DLLs, that would include everything from understanding structural aspects of language development, acquiring knowledge and skills about effective instructional practice. I mean, there's a lot of agreement, I would say, about what this means, but not a lot of action to actually incorporate this so far into the licensing and credentialing standards. Secondly, expanding opportunities, meaning instructional program opportunities for young DLLs to develop proficiency in both languages. Came up several times, the lack of valid tools to measure quality care and education for DLLs, and that, you know, in certain areas of practice there's more agreement about what that is, but that certainly we, you know, there's many pieces of that we could be moving on already. Those of you who work more at the state level, obviously there's a lot of quality rating efforts that are moving forward. So this is more of a state level issue about how do we reflect best practices for young DLLs in those rating efforts. Although those were things that were pushed by the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge, and that might be one of the areas that we can draw some learnings from that can be taken across the country. This one, we took a little liberty and put it in here. We thought it was implicit, but the expanding language and literacy skill development for low-literate and LEP parents, it's only, I think, just becoming evident to folks around the country what the loss of Even Start funding has meant. Sort of the policy battle was lost about two and a half years ago, but the money only ran out this past summer, and so a lot of the capacity is really drained out of the system just in the last 6 months or so. So a lot of the programs that were working to bring in immigrant parents with their kids and really get them on a pathway up into literacy, English language literacy development, have disappeared. So it does feel that we should be trying to piece together a lot of the, you know, what we know about what's been lost in terms of system capacity and try and figure out how to place the focus on that. Not clear that we can attach that in any way to the immigration reform conversation because, again, it's an unwelcome cost in the bill, and almost any of the costs in the bill will likely have to be paid by fees assessed to immigrants. And so, you know, but it doesn't look like where reauthorization is going to be moving. So just figuring out where, you know, where some sort of initiative in that regard could be placed. Maybe it's simply an appropriations ask, but definitely figuring out how to put a renewed focus on low-literate LEP parents appears to us to be a key policy priority. We've said before, the development of assessment instruments for DLL, since nearly all of the standardized assessments weren't designed or normed with them in mind. And then this issue of professional development for all teachers who are working with DLL students is one that that I want to connect over to some of what was in Rob's paper about the parent piece that, you know, we are seeing a lot of systems now that have 30 languages spoken in a classroom of 30 kids. And they really aren't sure what to be doing, you know. And there are the things that Linda was saying could start on Monday. But there's a big connection to the parent piece that we're talking all the time and putting a lot of money into parent skill, parent engagement, parent leadership programs, but not really tying any of that to issues like this, that the parents really could be getting more of the skill for actually developing L1 for kids at home. It's a perfect thing to plug into those kinds of programs, and yet, you know, there's still just this haziness about what do we want done with that money. It's money that's already on the table, so we think trying to figure out how to put it to better use is something that would be a welcome conversation with folks in government and something that might actually result in some good in the short term.
Okay, and then finally, the session on the unauthorized. This seems to mimic almost entirely HEROES 1 page, What Do We Know? All summarized on one slide. So here is some of the same factoids that are from HEROES slide, which we didn't anticipate, sorry. Just that one in three children of immigrants has an unauthorized parent. You know, we deported over 200,000 parents over the course between 2010 and 2012. We see this in the data, that the children with unauthorized parents have lower levels of cognitive development and educational progress. The very striking point that comes from Jenny's work, that they achieve 1.25 to 1.5 years less schooling over a certain period of their educational trajectory. We see the large effects in late adolescence as older children begin to exhibit anxiety and depressive symptoms. We know from our work on the DREAM Act that a significant number of the DACA eligibles are going to be parents with young children, although they don't appear to be showing up, as HERO pointed out, in the clinics as of yet. And we know the children of immigrants fare worse in immigration than in other legal domains. And finally, that even if in the best of all possible worlds with comprehensive immigration reform, it won't fix, if you will, the disadvantaged legal status that David describes, the disadvantaged legal position of immigrant children, of children of immigrants in the immigration system.
So you're going to be especially disappointed with this next slide because it really is hard to figure out how to fix a number of the things that were talked about. But I think Kelly had some good suggestions that we hadn't anticipated of ways to work better with the processes that they've established. But basically, there's the huge issue of exercising prosecutorial discretion in a way that would mitigate impacts on children of the unauthorized, including reducing unnecessary detainment. But, you know, obviously, that's a big piece to try and get right. It sounds like DHS means to get it right, you know, maybe that's one with more local involvement that the system could do what, at least in D.C., it's saying it wants to do. The issue of clear guidance on means-tested programs in HERO, you also talked about expanding non-means-tested UPK. So, you know, those the issues about the ways in which proving earnings and the like is a barrier to programs for which USC children are eligible. Is certainly one that I think we could all think through a little more and figure out how to work agency-related angles on that, I would say. Looking at the DACA-eligible folks with children who might be, we thought in particular about those that would be seeking to enroll or re-enroll in adult basic ed or post-secondary ed programs in anticipation of the window closing, you know, if a law is passed. Very likely the window would close on those, the ability of those who don't already have their high school diploma to actually get on a pathway to 2 years. We did look at that population in the big report that we did on the DREAM eligible population, and so we'd be eager to work with folks on how to think about that one a little bit more. And then this is, of course, the big one, or one of the biggest, with respect to waivers of inadmissibility, altering the standard for hardship so that hardship to children is taken into account. So a number of these are really, really big lifts in immigration law. But I think we were convinced after reading David's paper that that these are things that folks dare not speak of in many ways when it comes to immigration law, and it probably is time to be making the case in a more full-throated way. So then we also wanted to say that generally part of the problem with these separate spheres that we were talking about today. And the lack of coherent policy at the federal level related to immigrant children and families is because there's basically no brain circuitry at the federal level for folks who are working on immigration to be talking to folks who are working on family and children education issues and the like. And so for a while now we've been advocating a National Office on Immigrant Integration Policy. It's part of a report we did about a year and a half ago on executive actions that the president could take. We'd like to see it in a CIR bill and bumped up to an executive office of the president office, not simply something that's established via executive order. But we're happy to talk more or embroider sort of that idea a little further into the children and families area. With any of you who have an interest in that. Do you want to do the data piece?
This point came up any number of times today that we're sorely lacking in our understanding of, Jenny makes this point very strongly, sorely lacking in our understanding of the trajectory of children of immigrants within a lot of the data sets. A number come to mind that could deepen our understanding. In other words, they reformulate the new immigrant survey, we could have a little more understanding. Perhaps when we get to this issue of health and the health of immigrant children, the National Agricultural Workers Survey could be revisited. And of course, there is the second, when the DACA's come in for the second town, for the second round of DACA, that might be a point in time for data collection. And then finally, if we're going to make progress to comprehensive immigration reform, we should think of it, and maybe we should take the opportunity that we took in 1986 and build in a very robust survey of the legalizing population and to continue and follow them longitudinally. And if we don't start advocating for that now, it simply won't happen.
So that is our best shot, figuring that we only had your attention for a limited time at the end of this long day. But there are our emails if you want to tell us that we got it wrong, we forgot things that are just desperately important. We really are interested to hear, because this is what we're here for. This is what we do, and we really want to advance a very pro-immigrant family and child agenda in the new administration.
So thank you very much. You can contact us by email or afterwards, and I would just like to take this opportunity. Some meetings are harder to pull together, and some meetings are easier to pull together, and I want you to know this was one of the harder meetings to pull together, if only because of all the papers that you were given. And because of everybody's complex schedule. So I really want to thank Lisa Dixon and Kristen McCabe for helping us with this.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Young Children of Immigrants Conference, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/integration.